Good morning. Polls have him in second place. Today we conclude our extended conversations with Honolulu mayoral candidates with a man who wants to keep his job, Kirk Caldwell. Meanwhile, a bill to regulate ride-sharing gets a full Honolulu City Council hearing later today. We'll talk with the Senior Policy Communications Director for Lyft, who's not too happy about it. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. The Hawaii Harmonica Society is well into its second decade, building ensembles out of the humble mouth organ. We'll meet its president, Robert Omura.
It's a Wednesday, August 3rd. The conversation starts right after this news. We see you tapping your toes. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday on The Conversation and pretty much everywhere else. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. An issue that's been simmering for a while, so it looks as if it's coming to a head, yeah?
Quite possibly, but we'll see what happens after this first conversation this morning. Now, are casual rideshare drivers the same as taxi cab drivers? In essence, that's the central question being asked by the movement to regulate drivers for services like Uber and Lyft. It's shown up at the state legislature and in the Honolulu City Council in different incarnations. The latest municipal effort passed out of committee and is scheduled to be heard by the full council later today, which has Chelsea Wilson concerned. She is the Senior Policy Communications Manager for Lyft. She joins us now by phone from her office in San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you. Hope you are too. And thanks very much for giving us some time this morning. This has been such an ongoing issue and ongoing efforts both at the state level and certainly within the city council. What do you make of this concern to have drivers for Uber or Lyft be regulated in the same way as taxi cab drivers?
Sure. So Lyft is an on-demand ride-sharing app that connects passengers with an affordable ride. But part of that is the driver that passengers are being connected with is a local Honolulu driver who is the vast majority of the time doing this part-time. In fact, 80% of Lyft drivers drive 15 hours a week or less.
And that seems to be the central issue. Forgive me for interrupting you, but that seems to be the real issue that you've hung, you know, your case on, that you're talking about casual drivers, people who are not making a living from being a driver for, say, a taxi cab company, but someone who is doing this maybe just to augment their income a little bit.
Absolutely. I was actually talking to a driver who will be at today's hearing just yesterday, and she's a single mom. She also is a caretaker for her elderly mother. So she needs a job that allows her to take off whenever she needs, if she needs to take her child to the doctor or her mom to an appointment. And Lyft really allows her that flexibility. She's looking for a job that she doesn't have to jump through, you know, a whole lot of monetary hoops in order to participate in, and Lyft really offers her that.
So let's talk about some of the monetary hoops that we've seen come down the pike. The current bill that will be looked at later today is in its second draft. As it's progressed from the original bill that was introduced in April to where it is now, obviously your opposition to it has remained steadfast, but it has done so as the bill itself has changed a little bit. Is there anything in this second incarnation of the city council bill that would lead you to believe that you can work out a deal to be able to benefit drivers who would like to do this casually and also satisfy the city council?
Sure. So the newest draft is definitely moving in the right direction, but we still unfortunately have some very serious concerns with what's being voted on today. And so we really urge that the city council would take its time to get this right. You know, there are still a number of really unnecessary burdens that are placed on individual drivers that dissuade those part-time drivers from participating in ride-sharing. We've worked with over 35 states at this point and dozens of cities to find a way to craft regulations that prioritize public safety, but still allow ride-sharing to operate, but still allow part-time drivers to participate, and still keep this safe ride option available for people who live and visit the island.
When you talk about the barriers to entry for someone who would do this casually, is a $50 fee to do this, to be registered, that much of a barrier, or does it go more to the issue of having to have each individual driver licensed rather than the company itself, or sort of a combination of both of those things?
Sure. So it's a combination, and I think those two items are part of our concerns. But there are additional onerous items in the bill that would make it harder for part-time drivers to sign up on the platform. I think that the fee that you mentioned is one of our concerns. We're supportive of a fee structure that puts the onus on the company and not the individual driver. As I mentioned before, most of our drivers are looking for an economic opportunity that they can do flexibly, that they can do because they usually need it in a short period of time. So putting a monetary burden on these folks who are just looking to fill a seat in their car and share a ride just doesn't make a lot of sense for a ride-sharing model. There are other concerns that we have with the bill, I think including a provision requiring permanent decals on cars. Maybe that makes sense for a taxi who is, the car is being used 100% of the time for commercial use. But for Lyft drivers, they're using their personal car that the majority of the time is being used to take their kids to school, to get to the grocery store. There is a way, of course, to craft a requirement that makes it easy to identify a Lyft car, but also easy for a driver to remove that when they decide to turn off the app and just use their car for personal use.
So, for example, one of those, plastic decals that you can affix to your windscreen, say that looks like, it's time to have your tires rotated or time to get an oil change, those kinds of things that you see that, come back after you've had those services done, but you can peel them off and you can reaffix them if you wanted to because they're plastic.
Exactly. I think that's a great example. And we've really been able to work with regulators across the country to find a way that, again, sets a very high level of public safety, but that makes a lot of sense for ride-sharing drivers. And I think the key here is that those regulations have been separate regulations. They recognize that ride-sharing is a different model than a taxi. And so we're really hopeful that we'll be able to do that here in Honolulu as well. But we just don't think we're there today. We don't believe there is any need for the council to rush this through today. And we really urge them to take a step back, to talk to all of the stakeholders involved in this conversation, and listen to their constituents as well, the people who are using ride-sharing both as drivers and as passengers and seeing the benefits from it every day.
Yeah, Chelsea, we got to go in just about a minute or so, but it seems that the city council really wants to see drivers have a little skin in the game too, and that a $50 fee may not be seen as being, terribly onerous to have to pay if it's going to be something that's going to be good for 2 years. $25 a year, we pay a lot of things at that level and a lot more services at much greater cost. But in terms of, working with the city council, if in fact this is not something that happens today, what's Lyft prepared to do?
We're prepared, and we have been from, I think, the beginning of these conversations, really willing to be at the table and have a productive, collaborative conversation with the council.
But if they don't
really
want to do that
a way forward comes from working together.
Right, but if they don't want to do that for whatever reason, if they think that, this is the best thing they have and that this is the way to proceed, is Lyft prepared to say, we're just not going to be in this market?
We want to be in Honolulu. It's a really exciting, growing market for us. We do, though, have serious concerns, and we have in other markets had to pause, really to take a stand for regulations that we believe would against regulations that would stifle ride sharing and really remove an economic opportunity for people who use this. So, it's a little too early to say exactly what we would do. The regulations, if passed today, go into effect in January of next year. But we're hopeful it won't get to that point. We're really hopeful that the council will decide to delay today. and take the time to do this right.
All right. Well, we don't have that long to wait. We'll see what happens. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Chelsea Wilson is a Senior Policy Communications Manager for Lyft. The third reading of Bill 36 to regulate ride-sharing is on today's City Council agenda at Honolulu Hale.
Can the incumbent disqualify the contender?
I think the Republican nominee is unfit to serve as president, and he keeps on proving it.
President Obama tells Republican leaders to head for the lifeboats. He says the SS Trump is sinking. Anybody going to jump ship? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15 right now. And coming up, recruiting new members for a harmonica ensemble. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Umurokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaiti.
In today's backyard quiz, we're reminiscing about the Waikiki of long ago and about its early days as a leisure time destination. As far back as the 1400s, Waikiki was a marshy area where native Hawaiians raised taro and fishes, and Hawaiian royalty came to swim at its beaches and surf in its waves. In the 1860s, a road made it more accessible to foreigners, and over the years, local newspapers began to take note of the demographic shift. An editorial in the Hawaiian Gazette in 1881 suggested that somebody should build a hotel there, saying, quote, "There are a great many people who'd spend a few days at such a place, and some would even make an almost permanent residence of it." A few years later, somebody took them up on the idea. A beachfront resort opened in 1884 that offered private cottages for families along with bathing facilities. Writer Robert Louis Stevenson stayed in one of the cottages for 5 weeks in 1893 and wrote some of his best work there. This morning, we're looking for the hotel's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Ani Kailia Stevens from Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
It's never too late to begin playing music, as any number of members of the Hawaii Harmonica Society can tell you. Most of them are retirees. None of them are professional musicians, but all of them have a love for what they're doing. Robert Omura is the founder and conductor of the ensemble, and he's here in our studio. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Had you played harmonica for a while before you formed the society?
I started when I was 8 years old.
Well, I guess so, then. That would be quite a while. What did you like about it?
What did I like about it? Well, basically, it's making music. And with the harmonica, it's such a simple instrument that you can make any music that you would like to play. And if you know the tune, then you can play it.
It's nice to be able to carry it around in your pocket, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very light and very small, so easy to carry around. I guess it's the most, I understand it's the most popular instrument, musical instrument there is worldwide.
I would imagine, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You favor in the society, you play the tremolo harmonica, right?
I play the tremolo. All of our members play tremolo harmonica.
And those are the ones with two little parallel openings, right? Where you kind of get the
double
note.
Double reed. It has two reeds, and so it has a very mellow tremolo tune to the sound that comes out. It's very tremolo. Very mellow and
has kind of a shimmering sound to it,
right?
To my ears, anyway. Mm-hmm. So, how many are you in this group now?
I have currently average between 30 and 40 people during the year. We've gone, over the years. This is our 19th year now, and we've had well over 100 members over the years. And they come and go. And harmonica is an instrument that you can pick up anytime. And once you learn how to play it, then it's a matter of just playing the tune that you like to play.
Do a lot of your members come to the harmonica pretty late? I mean, did they just learn to join?
Yeah, most of my members in the 50s and older.
Mm-hmm.
And the youngest, I think, is around 51 or 52. But
were they experienced?
They're all retirees, yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, they're all retirees.
Were they experienced players before they came to you?
Many of them never played harmonica, never played any music, and start out by, but they enjoy music, and that's the reason they come out. And over the years, they develop the skill to play the instrument, and then they learn how to play different music, and then we teach them how to read notes.
Uh-huh.
And so then we can play any music that we can put into notes.
You know, Robert, whenever I meet somebody who says they love music, but they don't play an instrument and they wish they could, it makes me want to send them to you, right?
Because that's right. If they like music, then they can play harmonica.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty encouraging message to send out there. Maybe we can encourage a few people. But then you have to, it's your job to meld them into an ensemble, right?
Right, right. And when we get, the ones that fit that very well are those who come in not knowing anything about harmonica.
Really?
Not knowing anything about music, in fact. And those who come in with some skills, previous skills, sometimes have a hard time adjusting to a group playing the harmonica.
You mean because they're used to sort of going at their own
That's
pace?
That's right, playing their own style and playing their own way. And most harmonica players don't play by notes anyway.
Yeah.
And they play by what we say, play by ear. And in our group, we teach them how to play the harmonica by reading notes and following music that are put down in notes, standard notes, and mm-hmm. then we convert that to numbers. And then the numbers are on the harmonica, and you play according to the numbers.
Oh, really?
So everybody learns how to play.
Oh, so you say, for example, draw in on three, and that gets you C or something like that?
Yeah. And any song that we can convert to notes, numbers, then we play.
Mm-hmm.
Almost classical music, popular music, any kind of music that you can think of. Most young people, especially in America, play harmonica by what we call chord. They don't play the single note that
yeah.
we play. And we play the most common style of music that you find with that we play in Asia and in Europe. Americans play chord.
Yeah.
On the harmonica.
And they actually use a different harmonica, the so-called marine band harmonica.
We can play with any harmonica,
mm-hmm.
and we generally follow notes so that we can harmonize and play music that you know, what we call classical music, or standard music that's in note form, and then you can play it.
How large is your repertoire?
Oh, up to about 500-600 notes, music, 500-600 songs that we have.
That's pretty good.
It keeps expanding. The more songs we hear, the more songs we can put into notes, and we play. Like I said, many people come in not knowing anything about music, and they learn about music and the different kinds of music there is.
Well, I think you're really doing a good thing.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Great to meet you. Robert Omura is the founder of the Hawaii Harmonica Society, which is giving its 19th annual recital on Saturday at the Hawaii Mission Memorial, which is next to Honolulu Hale. And you can find out how to join and hear them on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A new poll shows Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell down 9 points to challenger Charles DeJoux, and it shows the issues on voters' minds 10 days before the primary. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the details in today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We might want to make a small addendum to that actually this poll was taken last week, so
right.
The issues that people were thinking about end of last week, but here we are.
Probably
10 days.
The same this week as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, probably so. But anyway, taking a look at all of this, any surprises here in the way this came out for you?
No, not necessarily. And I should just give the full numbers. That's 42% for Charles DeJoux, 33% for Mayor Caldwell, just 9% for Peter Carlisle, the former mayor. 16% were unsure. Or are going to vote for somebody else. There are 8 other candidates in the field, as you may know. But the fact that DeJoux has a 9-point lead just shortly before the primary certainly has to be cause for concern for Kirk Caldwell. And the reason, more than any other that we polled, that voters are going to pick one mayor over the other, one candidate over the other, is rail. We polled on rail, homelessness, ethics, and cost of living, which includes affordable housing, and overwhelmingly 3/4 of the people we surveyed said rail is definitely going to influence their vote, and rail is certainly the top issue of this election.
This is the first poll that you've done about this.
Right.
And as we always say with polls, it's a snapshot of what it looked like at that moment. But as this has been escalating and people very concerned over the issues that you identify in the poll, were there any other issues that came up for people that didn't make, say, those top 4?
Well, there's another thing that we polled. We found out that over half the people surveyed, and we surveyed nearly 900 people on Oahu registered voters, more than half feel that Oahu is moving in the wrong direction. Only a third feel that things are going the right way. And to bring up a rail again, remember, you really have Peter Carlisle and Kirk Caldwell with very similar positions on rail. They want to go the full route. They're not quite sure how it's going to be funded. I don't think anybody is. But then you have Charles DeJoux, who, while he is not a quote-unquote anti-rail candidate, he certainly seems to be attracting attention for his position, which is, you know, I'm not going to raise any more taxes until we come up with a plan. And he says he's open. He's been criticized for not having any specifics on that plan. But I think that's the thing that's relevant. Another thing that I took away from this is it's very much like just 4 years ago,
right,
where you had Kirk Caldwell and Peter Carlisle. Remember, Carlisle was mayor. Kirk was the challenger, and Ben Cayetano was the definitely anti-rail candidate. And remember how that turned out. Carlisle finished third, and Caldwell and Cayetano went on to the general, and Caldwell prevailed with 53% of the vote. So eerily familiar pattern here.
Looking at what the poll is showing today, though, if the similarities between Caldwell and Peter Carlisle are as we have seen them to be, a good chance that the mayor may be picking up some of those voters as this goes into the general, because it looks like nobody's going to get a clear 51% majority.
Right, right. And you need to get a majority in order to win the race outright on August the 13th. Yes, it's all in all likelihood some of those Carlisle voters will go Kirk Caldwell's way. But remember, Carlisle is only polling 9%. He finished at 25% 4 years ago. So there's less support for him this time around. But it looks like it's going to be a close one.
It's going to be a close one indeed. Thank you very much. And we'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Aloha, I'm Bird Sestair from Friends of the Library of Hawaii. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert, are you going into outer space on this one?
You know, I had this funny feeling you were going to ask me and whether or not I would fit in that payload.
I should leave that alone, but I just can't resist.
Well, you know, this project, we actually talked about it 1 year ago, because 1 year ago they actually had their first launch. And this is the second annual launch. There, it's a two-year project. So a team that was made up of community college campuses, including Honolulu Community College, Windward, Kapi'olani, and Kauai Community College, they all collaborated together to build this payload. And this payload is much more complex than the one they did last year. So mm-hmm. It has a couple of experiments on it that are pretty notable, and we'll get to talk a little bit about that today on the show. One of which is they've got a little mini rocket. It's called a sublimation rocket on the payload. So they're going to launch a little rocket off of the payload, you know, from the bigger rocket.
A rocket within a rocket.
A rocket within a rocket. Yeah,
to be launched.
It'll be interesting. These guys, college kids, they really put their heads together and came up with some interesting experiments and, you know, collaboration over this multi-campus arrangement. So we'll get to talk to them today at 5 o'clock.
Sounds like a winner, Bert. Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
That's a look at global news. Now taking a look at what's happening in Hawaii. We know our primary is now only 10 days away. This week, we spent time with each of the three top candidates for Honolulu mayor. On Monday, we spoke with Peter Carlisle, yesterday with Charles DeJoux, and today we talk with the man in the job who would like to keep it, Kirk Caldwell. Thank you very much, Mayor Caldwell, for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's always nice to be on your show, and I look forward to having a great conversation with you.
Well, here we go. Now, this race is reminiscent of past mayoral campaigns where rail has been the central issue galvanizing attention, and that certainly was supported by the Civil Beat poll out today. On your list of priorities on the website, though, parks and playgrounds occupy the first place, followed by environment, and then rail, and homelessness is last on the list. It seems to be out of sync with the top issues that are driving voters, and I'm curious why your list of priorities was organized that way.
You know, Bethann, I don't think it was listed in terms of what was number one, two, and three. I think what we're showing is to be mayor, it's not just about one issue. And we have a candidate in Charles who's running, I believe, basically to kill rail. I'm running for rail, as is Peter. But there are many other issues being mayor. And I think it's something that perhaps Charles doesn't understand. It's the nitty-gritty, everyday aspect of the job. And for me, I did pick five priorities. I added homelessness as the sixth one, because that's what I heard when I ran, and that's what I still hear when I run. It's not just about rail. It's about addressing the problems with our substandard roads that haven't been repaved going back 30, 40 years, and we've now repaved 1,100 lane miles. Our parks were neglected for decades, and we're finally starting to fix up restrooms and rebuild playgrounds and repave play courts. And that is a big part. Bus routes had been cut. We've restored a whole bunch of bus routes, including a new one coming in from the west side to get people to work here in the urban core, and particularly in Waikiki. Sewer infrastructure neglected. It's not something glamorous. You know, it's all underground. You really don't see it. We're spending over $5 billion on rebuilding our sewer system, so we have the capacity to build more housing to address our whole affordable housing needs. And, of course, homelessness, I mean, it's a big issue. And you know, my two opponents talk about nothing's being done. And I think the numbers speak for themselves. And ask those almost 1,000 people that have been housed, either individuals or families, has their life been made better? And absolutely it has. And 1,000 people is 1,000 people. And if we had not taken these initiatives, the homeless issue would have even been greater. Okay. So this is what the mayor is about, Bethann. It's okay. Tackling all the issues.
So let's talk about some of those specifically, though. Short of losing federal dollars that could stop rail altogether, the argument continues to center on how far rail can go with the monies appropriated or those that might be raised. We're told that the cost could reach $11 billion, may require debt financing to complete. You've said that stopping at Middle Street would perpetuate housing and transportation problems on Oahu, and that the island needs a multimodal means of quick transportation. That's a different message from it's all about rail. So are you saying that if we can't afford rail all the way, even with, say, additional property taxes from, you know, new builds, new units, other modes will have to be integrated?
No, I'm saying to build rail all the way to Ala Moana. All 20 miles, all 21 stations. I've always said that, Bethann. I answered the question honestly when the FDA said, how far can you get for $6.8 billion? I hated giving that answer, but we have enough to get to Middle Street with a contingency just in case. And it seems like we always need more money. I recognize that. But I never said stop, because we won't even get to Middle Street, Bethann, until 2020 probably. In the meantime, we work to find the additional money. And that is the big difference between me and Charles. In fact, you heard earlier this week, he was talking about putting buses on the elevated rail route all the way to Middle Street. So we're spending $6.8 billion to put a bus up there. And by the way, FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, who gave the $1.55 billion, did not give it to build an elevated bus system. They gave it to build a rail system that moved a lot of people very quickly from the west side into town and back.
So would that negate the whole deal then?
I think it would negate. I think Charles' proposal kills rail. And I just would like him to say, I don't support rail. Be honest. I support rail. Charles doesn't.
So what about the
FTA would demand the $1.55 billion back. They did not sign a contract to say, go build a bus system. They signed a contract to build a rail system. So we'd need to return the money, first and foremost, and we'd have a system that would not be functional, because you cannot move a lot of people quickly by bus on an elevated rail system. What I want to do is continue the last 4.3 miles. That's all we're talking about, Bethann. 4.3 miles from Middle Street to Ala Moana. That is 8 stations. And yes, we have a funding challenge. But to walk away because we have a problem, I think it's not what the people of this island expect. They want to see a completed system. And it is multimodal, by the way. The answer is not just simply rail. It's bus and rail combined with each other, creating a multimodal system. We've adopted that here in the city and county of Honolulu, and it's something I want to see all the way through.
The additional money, though, is still where everybody is getting
correct.
Really hung up on that, because to say we have about $7 billion that's gotten us roughly this far, and by 2020, who knows what costs may be, who knows what may happen with how the construction goes. We don't know what time may bring, but the costs we know from watching past always seem to increase. So looking at that maybe $5 billion that you'll have to find elsewhere, where is the elsewhere specifically to you? Is that really a matter of debt financing? And how
no.
Short-term is short-term?
Absolutely. It's the same type of financing we have right now. As you know, Bethann, we just have two sources of funding. We have the GT surcharge of 0.5%, and we have the federal money. And by law, those are the only two sources of funding we can use. So when Charles talks about it's going to bankrupt the city, no general fund money is used to build rail. None. Zero. And he keeps repeating this, even as I state to you right now, he goes out, he has a new ad trying to scare the people saying it's going to bankrupt the city. We can only use those two sources. And that's where I want to find the additional money. As I said, I want to go back to the federal government and ask for more money. They give about one-third for these New START systems. One-third at a $5.2 billion project is about $1.55 billion. If it's going to be somewhere between $8.1 and $8.5 billion, it drops to 19%. That's not fair. And I think we owe it to the taxpayers of this island to go back to the federal government and ask for additional money. But that's not the only source. I've been working with the private sector, those developers along the rail route, those large landowners along the rail route, and said, would you pay for a station or help build a station? And they've said they're open in exchange for, hey, will we rebuild their sewer infrastructure around stations to build more housing?
So some of this may be trade-offs.
This is a trade-off. And I think it's a win-win for both because we want more affordable housing. You heard the discussion last night. And how do you get that? You get it around stations where you don't need cars because people can ride rail. And you incentivize the development around stations by building things like capacity for sewer infrastructure that we're already doing. The other one is going back to the state legislature, the other source of funding. You know, there's this 10% withholding, they say, that covers the cost of collecting the tax. We know it's somewhere between $30 and $35 million that they withhold every year at the 10%. The entire Department of Taxation budget, Bethland, is about $23 million. So they're collecting much more than the entire Department of Taxation's expense.
Right. So what
expense.
I hear you saying is that there's money in there that hasn't necessarily been accounted for that could be
Well, it's
recaptured.
Money we could ask for back because right. at the end of the day, we are the capital city. The legislature wants to see a functional rail system in their capital city, and I think it's going to be difficult, and they need to ask the hard questions. I'm ready to go up there to answer their hard questions, but I think they realize they need to see this okay. system built, and they need a functional system.
So just in
system.
The interest of time, I just want to be able to encapsulate what you've said. So you said there's money that could be recaptured from that 10% skim. There is money that you could go back potentially to get from the federal government, also potential private sector
Correct.
Partners in all of this. Are there any memorandum of understanding with any of those? Talk is one thing, but to say, yes, I'm in, and here's my name?
Well, I don't think you'll get that, by the way. Mm-hmm. I think you need legislation passed by the legislature, no memorandum of understanding. It's either there's legislation passed or not. As you know, a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, I was at the legislature asking for a further extension to cover the shortfall, and we got it. Basically, instead of a memorandum of understanding, you get a law passed, signed into law. With the federal government, it absolutely would require renegotiation of the full funding grant agreement, which they're already asking for because they've asked for this recovery plan. That would be part of a renegotiation.
But with the private sector not even having those who've said,
so to get
yes,
on,
we'll do that.
So I'm trying to cover the two government, the state, the feds. With the private sector, yes, definitely there'd have to be some kind of written agreement because they're not going to give. Let's say average station is about $40 million. They're not going to turn over $40 million without seeing some type of commitment from the city in exchange. And yes, there'd have to be some kind of written agreement.
Okay, so let's move on. Homelessness has increased despite the number of people moved into housing, as you've talked about. That seems to point to an escalating risk factors for people who are at those margins of homelessness. You've also taken a lot of heat for your part of the response, compassionate disruption. The bottom line, though, is the struggle to find a place for people to go. Where are they going to go? We know we have different types of homeless people, but when it comes to veterans and low-income families and future Housing First participants, the linchpin is truly affordable housing, and that likely means sort of that dense urban core rental. How will you spur more of that type of building when developers seem far less inclined to build that when they can get a lot more given the land value and the price points that they're after?
So, Bethann, one thing, homelessness on this island grew by 1%. That's 37 people. And I think it's partly because of the number of people who are already housed. And we're housing them, by the way, by acquiring properties. The city has acquired properties. And in addition, we're working with landlords And we did this with the Homeless Veterans Summit, you know, to asking landlords to step up. So we've housed about 950 people in housing, permanent supportive housing. But to your question on affordable housing, I think that is something we need to address if we're going to remain a place where all types of people can afford to live here, not just the wealthy and the rest of us who work for the wealthy. And I'm extremely concerned. And this administration has approached it in three ways. One is through the accessory dwelling unit law that we passed last year, and more recently in a law I just signed into law 2 weeks ago that waives all permit fees for people who want to build a second home on their property between 400 and 800 square feet. So a small unit, which means it's affordable and it's rental. You can't buy it because it's part of your overall larger piece of property. There's 120,000 lots on this island, Bethland, that could be used for ADU, accessory dwelling units. We've seen a slow start, but I think there's a lot of interest. It doesn't require government paying anything into it. It just means we're waiving fees, permit fees, hookup fees, sewer hookups. But we're going to see more of these units being built, I think, in the coming years, that's going to start to provide affordable rentals, of which there are very, very, very few being built on this island. The second one, though, is through our rail stations. That's why I want to build the entire 20 miles, 21 stations, because around every station, we have already provided entitlements for developers so that if they build affordable rentals, particularly, but also affordable market, they get density bonuses, height increases, waiver of parking. You don't have to build parking because you're going to use rail. We're looking at forgiving sewer hookups and those kind of things so that they build to a market that they otherwise wouldn't build to. Because like you say, there's risk, right? The lower market you build to, the margin of profit diminishes. If you don't hit the market right, you can actually be underwater and file bankruptcy. The last thing is, right now on this island, if you build 10 or more units, you have to build 30% at 140% AMI, which means for a family of four, that's about $120,000. That's pretty high. So what we're looking at is requiring developers to build it maybe to an 80% to 120% AMI, but lower the requirement of, instead of saying 30%, maybe 10 or 15%, and then provide a lot of incentives to those developers, like issue bonds to help cover the cost of construction. Again, waive sewer fees,
right, but
park
dedication. In terms of the number of units, we're always told how behind the curve we are at all levels,
yes.
Whether it's, you know, for middle income, for high income, not so much, excuse me, but certainly for middle and low. Do we have to make peace that we're really never going to have enough units to truly meet this demand?
I think that's unacceptable to say we'll never have those units. What I think we need to do is change the system that we live in today, that we've lived in since I was born here in Waipawa in 1952. And that is through the type of programs that I talked about. It requires out-of-the-box kind of thinking and new initiatives. And if we don't do it, Bethland, your children and our daughter are not going to be able to return home here to live. And what do we become if we allow that to occur? So I say it's unacceptable. And I think the three legs of the stool I just described to you begins that process. Now, we don't change it immediately. We need probably 3,000 to 4,000 units being built a year to that more affordable level. We're starting to build some of those, but I think with the passage of particularly the third leg of the stool, I think you're going to see more of the type of units being built that we need.
Let's talk a little bit about public trust. According to the latest poll, the situation with the Honolulu Ethics Commission is one of the top issues that voters are carrying with them into the primary. After the ongoing turmoil with the city, the head of the Honolulu Ethics Commission, you know this better than anybody, resigned in June, saying he was no longer effective. Is there anything more that you could tell voters about your response to the commission's director and how the situation was handled, including perhaps maybe that it should have been handled better?
You know, what I would like to tell the voters and your listeners is that you have an ethics commission and you got an executive director that reports to the ethics commission. And I believe in a fully independent ethics commission. I've appointed three retired judges to the commission. And anyone who knows those three judges knows how strong, you probably know them, Beth Ann, at least some of them. These are strong, independent people. And to imply that somehow they're being told what to do, but secondly, that they'd actually do it is an insult to them. Now, we have in Charles someone who says that Chuck should be reinstated. Well, that's not independence. He wants to be a mayor who decides who should be the ethics executive director. That decision is not made by the mayor. That decision is made by the ethics commissioners. And those ethics commissioners accepted unanimously the resignation of Chuck Tato. And the majority of them were not appointed by me. So to somehow imply that I'm dictating to the commissioners what to do is absolutely 100% incorrect. These are independent commissioners, a bulk of which I didn't appoint, that have made decisions regarding Chuck Tato. Now, I don't know why they did it. And I don't think it's my business to know. It's their business to know and be independent. And I would never tell them what to do. I would never tell them they should reinstate or hire anyone. It's their job to do. It's the commission that needs to be independent.
One more thing in the interest of time, because we're going to have to say goodbye in a moment, but we've seen issues with getting accurate records of officers' discipline for misconduct, and Hawaii is still the only state without a standards and training board. You've said that the police department has your support. It's well managed at all levels, and you defer to the police commission to respond to the investigation of Police Chief Ke Aloha. How do you answer those who say that all of those things are very clear proof that HPD needs better oversight?
Well, I don't know how you reached that conclusion, Beth Ann, but on the answer about transparency, I absolutely believe there should be greater transparency. I do push the chief and others to respond more quickly when things occur and that they get the information out. I think transparency is extremely important. I understand that there's struggles here, and part of it is protecting confidentiality. But if you're asking me whether more records should be placed out there, yes, absolutely. When things occur, for example, in the Cachola case, and they had the film, I encouraged the chief to show the entire film.
Well, beyond that, just looking at the overall issue, people have had different examples that have called into question how transparent HPD really is or how much faith and trust they can put into it. And there's some wonderful officers, and then that you get these examples that we've seen, certainly the situation with the police chief, and people looking for some sense of being able to level the playing field by saying, here are the standards, here's the training, all of that should happen.
So Beth Ann, there's 2,100 police officers. There's 25 total employees in the Honolulu Police Department. And any number of that size, you're going to have bad actors in any organization. And there are bad actors. But again, the work that the Honolulu Police Department does every day makes sure that you and I live in one of the safest big cities in the United States. And I think a lot of credit goes out to these people for the hard work they do instead of just focusing on the few bad actors and demanding, you know, somehow saying the whole department is in disarray. But I agree with you, Beth Ann. Those who are bad actors should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
As always, I wish we had more time. Thank you very much for
making time. Thank you, Beth Ann. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell is wanting to retain his position. If you have missed any of our conversations or joined this one late, they're going to be on the archive at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's backyard quiz, the name means without a care in French, and it was the first hotel in Waikiki. It was little more than a collection of beach cottages when author Robert Louis Stevenson stayed there in 1893, writing home to his sister about a rambling beach hostelry nestled among coconut palm trees. It's best remembered as a leisure destination, of course, and as Stevenson wrote in the hotel register when he left, "If anyone desires such old-fashioned things as lovely scenery, quiet, pure air, clear seawater, good food, and heavenly sunsets hung out before their eyes over the Pacific and the distant hills of Waiana, I recommend him cordially to the Sans Souci." And that's the hotel name we were looking for. Nobody got it today, I'm surprised, but at 8:56, that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Take one multi-hoku award-winning artist, that's Kuana Torres Kahele, 2 back-to-back concerts of his music for the Hawaiian Islands, 2 Merry Monarch-winning hula halau, discount tickets for groups of 6 or more. This all adds up to a celebration of Hawaii you won't want to miss. For more about this upcoming fundraiser for your public radio station, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/events. I'm Derek Mawama of Kanikapula Sunday, and I'll see you there.
Bethann, we've had pretty good opportunity this week to make our decisions on the mayoral race, haven't we?
And a lot of people have already made those decisions, and they've been walking in or they've been sending in their ballots. So that's going to continue. But if you haven't yet done any of that, and you're going to go out and vote on the 13th, and you want to hear some of the conversations that we've had with the 3 mayoral candidates, they're all on our archive, hawaiipublicradio.org. And up tomorrow, we're going to have an update on veterans homelessness with Scott Morishige.
And a prayer for peace on the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, our BKOZHPR.
And again, if you've missed any part of this show or a past show, or there's something you just want to hear again, you can find it on the Conversation page, along with links to more information with guests and topics too. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkamp.
I'm Bethann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.